When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Russell Banks says of Louis-Philippe d'Alembert, his work is the work of witness, infused with love and admiration for the millions of sufferers who endure the violent disruptions of our time, with dignity, perseverance, and a love for one another that is equal to his own. And Edwige d'Anticott writes that d'Alembert is one of the great imaginative writers of his generation. On this episode of The Literary Life, recorded prior to the assassination of Haiti's president, Louis-Philippe talks about the Mediterranean Wall, his novel about migration, an exodus from war, famine, poverty, and the ravages of climate change. The Mediterranean Wall has been awarded the 2020 French Voices Grand Prize in Fiction. Please join me in welcoming Louis-Philippe d'Alembert. I want to congratulate you for this book. Quite remarkable. And I want to welcome you today to be on this podcast. I'd love you if you could tell us, you know, in your own words a little bit, just about what this novel is about.
Yes, it's a very difficult question, but I can say a story about three women coming from three different countries. One of them, Dima, comes from Syria, from the city of Aleppo. She's a middle-class woman fleeing the war with her husband and two daughters. She's a Muslim. The other one, the second one, is Sema. She's an Orthodox Christian from Eritrea, a country that has been living under a dictatorship since independence in 1993. And she dreams of becoming a teacher. Unfortunately, she has to do military service, which officially lasts 1.5 years. But in reality, it can last much longer. You know, as they say in Eritrea, you know when you enter, but not when you leave. So she decides with two friends to desert. The third one is Shoshana. She's a Jew coming from Nigeria, and she's fleeing climate change and poverty. In short, I can say we have three characters from three disparate religions, cultures, and nations. The three will meet first in Libya before boarding the same overcrowded boat, trying to reach Europe across the Mediterranean in search of a better life. Dima, for example, who has more money, travels on the deck of the boat. Sema and Shoshana travel in the hold. And when a mutiny occurs, the three find themselves on deck. Between the mutiny and the bad weather, the situation deteriorates because, the idea for me was to say that we are all on the same boat. And if this boat sinks, everyone perishes. We can see that, for example, today with the COVID pandemic, for example, you know. So that was, I tried to say with that novel.
Well, I think you succeeded. The Mediterranean Wall just being translated and just out by Schaffner Press, it was such a moving and kind of startling account of immigrants who were trying to leave repressive regimes for one reason or another, making their way to Europe, as we have seen countless times over these last number of decades. Your book is based on a real, real event. I remember it when, I think it was in, when was it, 2014 or so, or 2012? And there was a rescue that went on when a Danish freighter rescued a ship.
It was in 2014.
2014. Talk yes. a little bit about that and about what happened there.
You know, it was, first of all, I'm a journalist. I used to work as a journalist and after as a teacher also in university, maybe in United States, in Germany, in Switzerland once in a while. But I learned from my journalism practice to do research, I mean, in the country. And I went to Lampedusa. I don't know if you know Lampedusa. It's a small island in Italy. We received from 1992 a lot of migrants coming from Africa or coming from Middle East, for example. And I had to write a novel. I mean, and I tried to write a novel about migration because, as a migrant myself, I was fascinated by all those migration stories. And when I came there, I can meet a lot of people, a lot of migrants, people, women overall, coming from Africa and coming from Middle East, but a large part of them coming from Africa. And I was looking for information. I read a lot of papers, a lot of books also. And once I was there, for me, it was very hard to talk with these women, to hear their stories. You know, some of them, for example, spent 3, 4, 5 years to come from Africa to Europe, for example. And I mean, when I was doing my research, I found just one short paper about that boat in 2014 that was saved by Danish tanker. And it was a shock for me, you know. It was a very a shock, and I say, okay, I got the novel. The novel, I have to write the novel from that boat, you know, between the tension that was in that boat between African migrant and Arabic migrants. And I begin to write that novel, and here we are.
Yeah, no, and the structure of it is so compelling, because you kind of weave the stories of the three women, and we get to know them from the moment they decide to emigrate, right?
Yes.
So you understand the reasons why they did, and you learn about three very distinct circumstances that are representative of so many people's stories, right? And they merge when they come together in this tragedy. Because of that, you know, you kind of, I felt as a reader, as if I knew each one of them. So describe a little bit for us of Semhar. What was her inspiration? What caused that kind of feistiness in her?
Okay, thanks for the question. I understand. You know, I mean, people, for example, in Western country are saturated with news, with information, for example. No? They receive a lot of information, a lot of news all the time on their smartphones, on the internet, on television, in your newspapers, etc. And those information are often sensationalized. They see, okay, or we see, because I live in Paris, we see masses of threatening individuals for whom we can hardly have empathy. And for me, novel is or fiction is the opposite. It tells the story of one, two, or three people in that case, of three characters in whom the reader can recognize himself, or a brother, or a sister, or a friend, I don't know, characters he can identify with. This is what I try to do in that novel. By taking up the subject as a novelist, I mean, I wanted to show that behind the generic term migrants, there are above all human beings in all their complexity. I mean, with qualities and defects. For example, a woman like Dima, she's always struggling against her fears. She's quite racist, but she struggles against that. And I want to give back to those characters or to those migrants their humanity behind the statistics and the fear they inspire, in some people.
You know,
that was I tried to say to do.
I'm glad you mentioned empathy, because that is the one thing that comes through loud and clear in The Mediterranean Wall. You know, we as readers empathize with each one of the characters, with all of their faults, with all of their strengths.
Yes.
And, you know, it reminds me of a quote that I read somewhere from Madison Smart Bell, who says, "Who better to write from inside the Mediterranean crisis than a Haitian novelist living in France?" So talk about how your own background made you empathetic, your own personal journey that you had, and how that plays into the empathy here.
You know, I've been, I don't know how to say that exactly. At a very, very young age, I was confronted with stories of migration. In my family and my circle of friends, for example, I saw many people leave, especially to the United States or to Canada, for example. And later, when I was 23, I was the one who left for Europe. And I didn't live only in Europe. I live in France, of course. I live in Italy. I've been living in Israel, for example, in Jerusalem. And I taught in Switzerland, in Germany, in the United States. And I travel a lot. I was always traveling, and I'm still traveling, but a little bit less from the beginning of the pandemic. But I was always traveling. I travel a lot to Africa and the entire American continent. And when I write a novel, for example, about migration, I naturally draw on my own experiences as a migrant. And allowed me to empathize with my characters, because I grew up in a country until 23 years old. I grew up in Haiti. I was born and I grew up in Haiti. And in Haiti, we have a lot of people, leaving the country, not only to the United States, but to Canada, to, for example, Dominican Republic, the French islands. There is a lot of migrants in Haiti. But that means migration is part of my story, and I can even say that it's part of my identity as a human being. Because when, for example, I, as an Haitian, or not only as an Haitian, I can say, like as a people was born in the American continent, migration is part of my identity. When I'm, for example, I'm talking about a boat, I'm talking about people traveling on the deck and people traveling on the hold of the boat. I'm talking also about the Middle Passage.
That's what it reminded me of.
I'm not only talking, about a recent story.
Right.
But it's not necessary for me to do an essay talking about the Middle Passage, because a lot of people did it before me. So when I was talking about empathy, I'm talking also about bad things, because for me it's very important. It's very important because I feel it in my person. I mean,
well, certainly, you know, living in Miami as I do, and living through, you know, the last 60 years here, you know, Haitian quote boat people are certainly something that, you know, comes into our consciousness as just people living here, and the idea of individualizing them and not making them, you know, as this kind of blanket non-entity having people who come here and not seeing them as individuals. You give each of the people that you write about a face, a personality, a sensibility, and we as readers can empathize with that, as you know, which is what great literature can do. And certainly, you know, being from Haiti, which is an island, you know, where there is so much, as you say, migration built into the culture because of the fascism that had been there for so long. I mean, that's what I thought of.
Yes, you know, I would say one thing, you know, when you are writing, I think I'm not the only one, when you are writing, you are not writing alone, I could say. You are writing with your identity. You are writing with your history. And for me and for everyone, I think history is also identity. And when I'm talking about both, I'm talking about Middle Passage, but not only Middle Passage. I'm talking about my generation, because I'm from a generation, you know, in the 80s, for example, in the 70s, we didn't use the word migrant. We used boat people.
Right.
In the 70s or 80s, we used to talk about boat people, Haitian boat people, Cuban boat people going to United States, for example, and or in Europe, there used to be Vietnam, boat people coming from Vietnam or Cambodge or Laos. So I'm writing also with that part of my identity, you know, because those stories became history, and they are part of myself. I can't write also, I mean, a novel about migration without those stories, without the boat people story, or without the Middle Passage story.
It informs, completely informs your sensibility, you know,
yes,
the whole history that
yes,
you have. Let me ask you a question about, I mean, 180 some odd people died in the actual tragedy. Something like 500 some odd people were saved. And then you write about what happens on the freighter just so wonderfully, which is where everything kind of, you know, reaches a climax. And I don't want to spoil anything for anyone. to tell them what it is, other than it's extremely compelling. But so this happened, you know, a number of years ago, and we hear stories now of, you know, what's happening in Europe and what's happening, you know, what's happening in Europe right now with that same kind of migration. What is your take right now? What's happening in France and England, you know, putting that hat on, the hat of a journalist, that of the hat of someone who is so aware of when immigrants come into what seems to be, you know, we had our own situation in the United States, which was and continues to be, you know, completely, you know, disturbing, you know, with our last president. But so what's happening there in Europe right now?
You know, the flow of migration has slowed. In fact, partly because of the pandemic. That doesn't mean things are better.
Right.
Besides, you know, the principle of journalism anyway, we talk more about what's close by. Europe, Africa, and the Middle East are far away from the United States. I mean, it's normal. It's in the United States, for example, I think it's easier to talk about refugees coming from Central America or coming from the Caribbean. But here in Europe, we are still talking a little bit less about migration, because people, they stay, some of them, not in their countries, but in countries like Libya, for example, or Algeria or Morocco. We didn't give a solution to that problem.
Yeah, nothing has been solved, right?
Nothing has been, that's the word, you know? Right. Nothing has been solved, you know? For example, okay, to write that novel, I stayed on the island of Lampedusa in Italy between January and February 2018. But, you know, people in Lampedusa faced that problem, and they are still facing that problem. You know, people in Libya, for example, they are still facing that problem. But we didn't talk about that. You know, the principle of journalism or the principle of news, you every day you have, I could say every hour, you have an information or news more important than the others. Right. But now we are just talking, everyone is talking about the pandemic. Right. But the problem still exists.
Are there people being turned back? Is there?
Yes.
So the wall, there is still the Mediterranean wall, right? Mm.
No, there are still people coming in Europe. I mean, there's not a lot of people like 2 years ago or 3 years ago. But once in a while, overall in Italy, you know, there are what we can say, roads. We have so many roads from sub-Saharan Africa, for example. If you come from Nigeria, you travel from Niger and from Niger the desert to come to Libya. And if you come from Eritrea, you are going to travel through Sudan, and there is a lot of roads. Once we are in Libya, for example, from the death of Gaddafi, you know, the country exploded completely. There is no state. There is a lot of gangs, more or less, and in between those gangs, they control all the migrant traffic, and it's even if a country like Germany, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, received a lot of people, 1,200,000 people, I mean, they received. But the other countries, the other European countries didn't do the same, first of all. But even if it wouldn't be enough. But the problem is not the migrant flow. The problem is how to deal with Western and southern countries,
right,
how to change the rules, how to to process, to have a kind of equality, right, in when we are doing exchanges, because we have to find a way to fix people in their country. And right, to fix right, people in their country, you are not going to fix people just, okay, I open the door and I just let in 1 million or 2 million. But the problem will be the same after 5 years or after 3 years.
I was going to say the solution then, or at least to start the solution, would be to look into the countries and finding the reasons why people are leaving. We need a redistribution.
Redistribution, that's the word.
We need a redistribution. The way societies collapse is when there is such a disparity between those who have and those who don't have.
And we don't have. That's the point.
And we have that worldwide now. And there will always be people on the move with that disparity being what it is, right?
That's the point. If we still have that kind of societies in the world, for example, 2% of the population have 80% of the richness of the planet. It won't work anyway. It won't work. You can give billion of million of dollars, but it won't work. People have you're supposed to have, for example, this is how to redistribute the richness of the planet, the first of all, but also that don't support, for example, dictatorship in some countries.
Right.
And it's also important the Western countries, the very important countries like United States or like Europe or that, like other countries, they still support those dictatorship, or they still exploit the richness of those countries. We will still have those migrants.
But we have, unfortunately, in some countries, including our country over the last number of years, a hostility to people who are on the move. Mm-hmm. And then you're making the situation only worse in that sense. And yeah, I imagine that that's happening in some Western European countries as well, right? Where it become, migrants become political footballs and, people use it in order to get political advantage, and it becomes even more profound, how difficult it is for them.
Yes, it's very difficult it's more difficult in some countries than other. For example, in the former Eastern countries, like Poland, Hungary, and things are very rude, are very tough against migrants. In Western Europe, it's a little bit less, but even if it's less, I mean, there are kind of hypocrisies in the way they treat those people. If you don't give, you don't, how do we say that even in French? If you don't give papers, to those person, it's easy to exploit them.
Right.
They don't exist.
Yeah.
They don't exist because they're supposed to live not officially. They can't live officially. They don't exist. So anyone can exploit them.
If they're undocumented or they don't have any cards or anything like that.
That's the way.
Most definitely. If they don't have visas or they're not permitted in the country. But I think, when we talk about all of this and it seems so terribly hopeless sometimes and so complicating, I think one of the things that your book proves is that if we can become empathetic, literature can serve the purpose of trying to bring people together, or having someone at least understand what somebody else is going through. And if they at least understand it and they feel that character's pain and suffering, they might be moved to try to do something about it as well.
As a novelist, I can do it for single person, But I can't, unfortunately, doing it for a lot of people or for the government. And I would like, but I can't. And it's a pity. I'm so sad about that, but that the way it is. But as a human being, I'm just trying to do my best, to do my part, and to create. Even if, for example, I can change the mind of two or three people, I say, okay, it's a victory for me, just to accept the way that the people, for example, if there are few people leaving the country just for pleasure, just to travel. I mean, the extra majority of people, when they are traveling, they are escaping from something. They are escaping from poverty. They are escaping from dictatorship. They are escaping from war, but they are not doing it. They are to do, I don't know. They don't want to do a cruise, for example. They are escaping from something. Right. And if we can understand that, I think it would be a great step for humankind. I mean, it would be.
Tell me who you think are some of the other writers that you admire, some other books that you can say cover not the same territory, but who are, you know, who are inspirational for you in terms of, you know, the shared sense of trying to get people to understand what other cultures, other people are having to go through.
I could say a lot, but I mean, first of all, I mean, my very professors were the Russians, like Tolstoy, Dostoevsky. They were, because I was an adolescent when I discovered those novels. And they are my very, very professors. I mean, the first professors. And after that, I could say, Latin American writers, who they call the boom of Latin American literature.
Alejo Carpentier.
Yes, because I have a PhD in comparative literature, and I had my PhD on Alejo Carpentier, but not Alejo Carpentier. I would say García Márquez, sure. Or someone like Vargas Llosa or Miguel Ángel Asturias. But there are some others, like Toni Morrison. I learned a lot from Toni Morrison. In English, I have three person I admire the works, that like Toni Morrison, Philip Roth, and Isaac Bashevis Singer. And wow. Those three, they are just on the top for me.
I, you know, Isaac Singer lived in Miami for a good period of time. He lived on Miami Beach, and he came into the bookstore a fair amount of time. And one of the great experiences in my life was really getting to know him before he died. And his writing I agree with you completely. And Toni Morrison as well. I mean, you know, what she did for writing and giving voice and showing people a way to write and giving voice to people and giving them the okay to be able to write about themselves without necessarily the white gaze, you know, I mean, is really something too. When you were a little kid growing up, there was an outdoor cinema near where we lived.
Yes, because we... we used to live near from a drive-in, you know, a drive-in in the 70s, for example. There were four drive-in in Port-au-Prince, and we live nearby one of them. And I didn't, it was completely impossible to hear, because we used to see the screen and the movies. And for me, it was very, very useful, you know, just to follow a story, but like a mute cinema. I mean, like a mute movie. And
you had to narrate the words. So you had to sort of create a narrative for it.
That's the way. That's,
so that was early training to be a novelist as well, I think.
I think it helped me a lot, I think. I read also a lot, there's no problem. But I think that experience for me was very, very useful.
Do you have much experience here in Miami?
Yes, I do have, because like Haitian, like, I mean, almost all Haitian people, I do have family in Miami. I do have family in New York, in the United States, so I have no choice. I'm supposed to have experience with Miami. Maybe every 2 years I come through Miami, because even to see my family or to go to Port-au-Prince, because when I'm traveling to Port-au-Prince, okay, I stay to Miami, but I don't have experience with the Miami Book Fair.
We would love to have you come, whenever you'd like to.
By the way, my latest book of poems, Cantique du Balbutiement, was published in September of last year, and just yesterday it has been awarded the François Copé Prize by the French Academy.
Oh, congratulations. That's
right. Thank you. And I've learned from poetry an extreme attention to language.
I'm going to surprise you with a question. Would you do me a favor? Do you have the collection of poetry there somewhere? Do you have it?
I'm my computer. I don't know if I can have. Hold on, if I can find something.
Could you read a poem in French?
Yeah, I'm just trying. If I find one, hold on a second. I'm trying to find one. One of them, also, I think one of my poems was in the what this week was is in what I don't know how to say that even in English. I mean, this is the what they call in France brevet, is an exam for the third grade in secondary school. Mm-hmm. And that poem was on the program.
Oh, really? Wow.
And the title is Voyage. Quand j'étais jeune, je rêvais de vivre à Paris, New York, Rome, Jérusalem, Dakar ou Santiago. Maintenant que j'ai vécu à Paris, à Roma, à Yerushalayim, que je connais New York, Dakar et Santiago, je rêve des lumières absentes de la ville natale. Quand j'étais jeune, je rêvais de vivre ailleurs, partout. Quelque part dans le monde, j'enfourchais alors une branche d'arbre ou l'une des nombreuses étoiles de la mer, de la nuit caraïbe, vaste et profonde, comme seule en évente l'enfance. Et je m'envolais, loup-garou, insouciant et végétarien, loin de mon quartier, loin de ma ville, avant que les notes fausses d'un coq, trahi par ses cauchemars, ne viennent m'arracher au tiède clin d'œil des premiers rayons du soleil. Quand j'étais jeune, je rêvais de vivre la vie. Je partirais vers un monde sans fin où les lumières auraient emprunté leur éclat à nos rêves d'enfants, aux reflets argentés de la mer, au soleil, à l'eau de la ravine qui accueillait nos ébats clandestins le lendemain des jours de pluie. aux avions dont l'envol matinal se confondait avec la saison des cyclones. Maintenant que j'ai voyagé, que je connais le monde et la beauté de ces femmes, les yeux rieurs de ces enfants, l'arrogante impuissance de ces hommes, maintenant que j'ai vécu partout, je rêve de vivre chez moi. Maintenant que j'ai voyagé, que je voyage, j'ai envie par moments de m'arrêter comme lorsqu'enfant nos semelles vagabondes nous ramenaient à la maison dans l'espoir de troquer la sueur, la poussière et la faim contre une bonne douche, des vêtements moins crasseux et un hypothétique repas. J'ai envie de tout arrêter et de rentrer au pays de l'enfance, mais j'ai perdu le chemin du retour. Quelques rapaces amblyopes et gourmands aura gobé les cailloux que j'avais oublié de semer.
Oh, that's beautiful. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Luis Felipe.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for being on the Literary Life.